bit late. We go till 2:30. We might be able to push that envelope with the room and with Glenn just a little bit, but hopefully we'll have some time for questions after Glenn's presentation. So,
great. Thank you very much.
Just give me a second to pull up my slides, and I think we'll be good. Oh no. Okay. Well, we'll go that way then. I'd like to thank Professor Hopkins for that great introduction and for inviting me here to speak to you today. And tell me, can you hear me in the back of the room?
That's fine.
Okay. Am I mic'd?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. For me, I often lean into the mic. So in recent years, technology has supercharged the dark art of agitprop, that potent mix of political agitation and propaganda that Russian revolutionaries gave to the world more than a century ago. While attention now centers on how its current devotees are exploiting social media to sow mistrust, intimidate, provoke, and polarize, for China that is but one facet of a much more ambitious suite of influence operations, and that are designed to affirmatively shape and control discourse. True to its Leninist roots, the Chinese Communist Party depicts public opinion as a battlefield upon which a highly disciplined political struggle must be waged and won. This battlefield knows no borders. It encompasses a full panoply of domestic actors as well as foreign universities, business and policy elites, and the media, among others, perhaps even fire alarms. History is a fiercely contested sector on this battlefield. As Orwell once observed, who controls the past controls the future, and who controls the present controls the past. Cognizant of this, the CCP is shrewdly leveraging its economic muscle and the technologies of the information age to globalize its domestic censorship regime and to enlist observers everywhere, often without their knowledge or consent, in an alarming effort to sanitize the historical record and propagate its own competing narratives. Now, you can think of my talk first as an empirical, evidence-based exposé of that, something we've long understood and suspected, but never systematically proven or teased apart analytically. And you can furthermore consider the talk I'm about to give as a case study for how we can bring new computational tools to bear on rather old historiographical questions. Not as a supplement for traditional close reading, but as a complement. But I hope that you'll go further. After all, the CCP has always practiced censorship and always manipulated the past, and our source base has never been immune from that. What has changed is the party's ability to change what we here on our screens see day to day, and its clever use of its immense market power and the institutions of liberal, rules-based societies to cement its positions and narratives. In a creepy sort of way, it is Xi Jinping's world, and we are all living in it. Now, if you accept the evidence I'm about to present to you, then the next question is, what are we going to do about it, individually and collectively? Do we have the strength, the organizational capacity, and the will to resist? From the responses I've seen so far, I am not encouraged, and we can talk about more of that in the Q&A. It must be said that the timing of all of this is impeccable. Economic and technological disruptions to our information ecosystem are eroding our capacity to detect, much less resist, what is happening. It's an information war. For example, motivated by thrift and efficiency, many of our academic libraries are shedding old volumes and outsourcing increasing portions of their collections to digital online providers, secure, or at least trusting in the knowledge that those providers will supply full replacement value and guarantee the integrity of their products. But much can go wrong with that bargain, especially since many of these providers are commercial market-driven ventures subject to commercial pressures. They may adhere to different values, priorities, and standards of stewardship than traditional libraries, and they may be accountable to different constituencies, such as shareholders. Furthermore, things can go spectacularly wrong when they confront the demands of a mercurial censorship regime and the authoritarian government behind it, as with the People's Republic of China. Two recent cases demonstrate the dystopic possibilities of this new reality. In the summer of 2017, acting on a request from its Chinese importer, Cambridge University in the UK quietly removed 315 articles and book reviews from its online edition of the venerable British academic journal, The China Quarterly, which is a standard in our field. Now, the press ultimately reversed itself when exposure led to widespread condemnation. But in a separate case, the German academic publisher Springer Nature, which among other things publishes Scientific American, held firm, effectively arguing that its censorship of more than 1,000 of its own publications was the cost of doing business in the PRC. Now, not long ago, such post-publication censorship was toilsome. Tearing out passages or seizing and destroying entire volumes required physical control of the relevant texts, and there was always the possibility that some would slip through the net to bear future witness. I have some examples of that to share with you right now. For example, here are two before and after photographs taken of the state funeral of Mao. One is before the arrest of the Gang of Four. One is the official photograph cleaned up after the Gang of Four was arrested to erase them from the historical record, as if they had never been there. The second example comes from one of the journals I'm going to talk to you about today, and it's an old-fashioned censorship, the way they did it when the journal was originally published. Political Legal Research was the first academic law journal published in the PRC. It debuted in May 1954, and here are a couple pages taken out of the first issue that was printed, which was released in May 1954. Now, one of the articles right here, interesting, my pointer doesn't work on the screen. One of the articles introduced right here is called Certain Questions in the Study of the Party's General Line. Now, something about this article must have offended the censors in its own day, because within several weeks, all of the issues of this journal that were printed were withdrawn. And the issue was reprinted 2 months later, in July, with this article removed. And in order to make room for that, all of the subsequent articles had to be repaginated. So they all show up with new page numbers that are exactly 4 less than the old. This is the way they did it in the day, and the reason we know about it, of course, is some of the original May issues managed to slip through the net and survived. Mind you, this is an inauspicious start for a law journal, and things are only going to get worse, as I'm going to show you. Now, that's a drag, doing it this way, and times have changed. Increasingly, our knowledge resides not in tangible objects dispersed redundantly among libraries and collectors, but in evanescent bit streams that are delivered from distant servers along a centralized distribution chain. As the Cambridge and Springer episodes illustrate, the providers who control these servers can silently alter our knowledge base from their back offices without ever leaving their desks, making one alteration after another, leaving us none the wiser, each with the potential to propagate instantaneously around the globe. For censors, the possibilities are mouthwatering. Digital databases offer them dynamic, fine-grained mastery over memory and identity. And in the case of China, they are capitalizing on this to engineer a pliable version of the past that can be tuned algorithmically to always serve the party's present. Consider again these two academic law journals from the PRC in the 1950s, Political Legal Research, which was published in Beijing, and also Law Science, which was published in Shanghai. The original print editions of these journals document the emergence of China's post-1949 legal system, the communist legal system, and the often savage debates which seized it. Few libraries outside of the PRC have complete original print runs of these journals. And with the advent of convenient digital editions, the few that do have typically relegated the old paper volumes to off-site storage. For most people around the world, digital access, online access, is now the norm. Now, unfortunately, the online editions of these journals have been redacted in ways that materially distort the historical record, but are nonetheless invisible to the end user. The consequences of this are as unsettling as they are deliberate. The more faithful scholars are to the sanitized historical record in this adulterated source space, the more they may unwittingly serve China by fulfilling the agenda of the censors. Take the issues originally published in the PRC from 1956 through 1958. This is the period of the Hundred Flowers campaign and the anti-rightist campaign, which was a backlash that followed. Only two online databases, both hosted in the PRC, currently offer full-text coverage of these journals, and their holdings are identical, right down to exactly the same 63 articles that are missing, which comes to about 8.5% of the total article count in this three-year sample, or about 11% of the total page count. They've been erased from the online editions of these journals. Some of the individual issues are missing as much as 50% of their total page count. And notably, the gaps are concentrated at the tops of the tables of contents, which suggests that the censors are now suppressing exactly the articles that these journals once proudly led with. Furthermore, the temporal distribution of these omissions is telling. They begin abruptly in mid-1957, when a wave of political persecutions known as the Anti-Rightist Campaign began, and then they taper off in the following months as the campaign wound down. For the years in question, as I said, about 8.5% of the articles are missing. Here's an example of what that looks like. Here's a scan of the original paper table of contents from one of the issues, the fourth issue of 1957 from Law Science. And the red box indicates the articles that are missing from the online edition. As I said, they come from the top of the table of contents. Now, here's a translation of them. My favorite one, personally, is American Rule of Law Travels the Road of Fascist Dictatorship. But you can get the sort of a sense of what the politics of the moment were. 30 of 72 pages from this particular issue are missing. Now, what does this look like online when you go to those two databases? Here are the 10 articles. There are originally 24 entries in the table of contents, only 14 of which are visible on the online journal. And there's no indication that anything is missing. In fact, they're numbered consecutively. This particular database, the only hint, and you would have to drill down to the actual table of contents for that journal, would be some page gaps in the page number sequence here. But you'd have to be attentive to that, and you wouldn't necessarily catch what the significance of that was. This other database doesn't even include that hint. There's no indication that anything is missing at all. So you would think that this is a complete record of that issue of the journal. More importantly, when you use the search engine for this database, of course it is blind to the missing content, so the hints it returns don't include it. It creates an alternate kind of reality, a sanitized reality with an important part of history missing. Now, why study this computationally? At some point or another, I have read most of the articles in these issues in their original paper form. And while I formed intuitive judgments about why some articles might have been missing and why some might have been included, based on my deep traditional grounding in the subject matter as a historian, I kind of thought, well, maybe those subjective hunches aren't going to persuade you in the audience. And more importantly, trying to keep all 737 documents in this sample, which comprises about 4 million characters straight in my working memory, is not really a recipe for analytical success. And so I began by asking several basic questions about them. Are the online omissions topically stochastic or deterministic? If stochastic, I would expect to see a random distribution among the included and missing articles, with no obvious features separating one set from the other. This would make the case for intentional censorship really hard to sustain unless, for example, it was completely arbitrary or beyond what the variables I was looking at was able to capture. If deterministic, I would expect to see some structure in the data, some lumpiness or clustering. And then the next step, if I detected that structure, would be to try to characterize it, to ask which features accounted for the inclusion of some articles and the omissions of others, and to measure the strength of those effects. Strong, unambiguous findings would suggest that I could not only effectively reverse engineer the criteria that are triggering the censorship and reveal the arguments and topics that the censorship is selecting for and against, but I could also maybe get at the motivations of what the censors are. And so the scope of my corpora, because one journal was published in Beijing and the other published in Shanghai, also allowed me to explore these questions, not just in time from 56 to 58, but also in space, to experience how these campaigns played out in different cities. And so I did that, Beijing versus Shanghai. I can say more about my methodology if we have time at the end and my workflow, since this will be somewhat abbreviated. So the question, is there structure in this data? It might be hard to tell since I can't make this full screen,
But if it was a completely random distribution, and all of the slides that are going to come, red stands for censored, blue stands for not censored, you would expect to see no distinguishing features setting aside the red and the blue points. Now, I've got all the red points labeled with the article title that corresponds to that data point, so I can sort of follow up exactly which article is clustered where. And as you can see, the red points tend to be all clustered over here, and they tend to be more tightly clustered over here, not so much over here. So there suggests that there's something going on here. This is a standard statistical technique called principal component analysis, PCA. And so it indicates that there is some sort of deterministic logic that is guiding the sensors. But we don't know what that is right now, right? We just know that this is not purely random, that there's some sort of logic to it. So then the next question is, on what basis is the censorship happening? A procedure known as chi-squared feature selection. Now, I don't want to get too nerdy here, but it allows you to zero in on the terms that are most closely correlated with the missing articles. And on that evidence, I am basically comfortable attributing the omissions to deliberate targeted censorship. Here, basically, are the terms that are correlated with censorship, most closely correlated with censorship from each journal. For example, rightist element in political legal research is the top term. The campaign to eliminate counter-revolutionaries is another one. And for those who are statistically minded, I have the p-values associated with each calculation also. And these are all the values that are under the typical 0.05 confidence level. So generally speaking, in statistical terms, there are strong, reproducible, confident effects here. Similarly, if anybody who knows the history of the 1950s in China, you'll see Wang Zhaoxuan here, who's a very famous figure. He was a journalist in the Republican period and was one of the principal targets of the anti-rightist campaign in the PRC. Very famous figure. He's the second name in the law science list. Rule of law is term number three. Kuomintang is the term number four, and so on. So you get the sense that there really is something political going on here. These are not random terms. So far, my results sort of confirm what we already know from the history. One of the interesting things that you can find when you look at the data this way is that it looks like the sensors are responding to different proximate triggers in each city and journal. For example, in political legal research, more than half of the terms are actually personal names, which suggests that they're singling out particular individuals for attack. And those individuals, of course, represent ideas that they want to attack, and so they're sort of made to be the representations of those ideas and punished as examples for others. There are fewer individuals in the law science community here, and more ideas or other entities like Kuomintang, scientific, rule of man, rule of law, things of that nature. Another thing that becomes apparent is each journal, the terms in each of these lists, is tied to the city in which it's being published. The people listed here, they're all from Beijing. So this journalist, going after local figures, the people listed here are all from Shanghai, with one exception, former Dean Roscoe Pound of Harvard Law School. And he's here only because of his close association with the first figure, who was one of his proteges, a 1935 graduate of Harvard Law School named Yang Zhaowang. And I'll talk about him more in a moment. So that's sort of an interesting finding, too. Now, one could surmise that the censors are pursuing different aims here, but really what it all comes down to when you do the close reading and you know the subject matter well is that they're each focused on a common set of problems, the controversies that rent the emergent PRC legal system. In mid-1957, budding debates over matters such as judicial independence, the transcendence of law over class and politics, the presumption of innocence and the heritability of law abruptly gave way to vituperative debates about those ideas and about their sympathizers. And every person listed in these two lists was singled out and caught up in that shift and persecuted as an example to others. The majority of the remaining selected features are also referred to that backlash, like rule of law, for example, or Kuomintang. So by sanitizing the record, the censors have distorted our understanding of the history and of the struggles to fight and determine the shape of the young PRC legal system. This conveniently absolves the CCP from having to face up to the mortifying contempt for the rule of law and for law that defined its early history, and its suppression of those who dissented from that contempt. And it's into that space that it can instead substitute its own new version of history. To appreciate how the censors are actually purposefully rewriting history, we can examine the terms most closely associated with censorship from each journal. And I took the top term in each of those lists that I showed you on the previous slide. Here I've isolated those terms, plotted the articles in which they appear chronologically, and then color-coded them according to the censorship status of the articles, red being censored, blue being not censored. And each data point corresponds to one particular article in this corpus, and then the amplitude of the data point refers to the weight of the term in that article. So what can we glean from this? Well, let's take rightist element, for example, the term correlated most closely with censorship in political legal research. You can see right here that in our 3-year sample, about half of the rightist elements have been wiped from the historical record, from the online edition of this journal, which at the very least distorts our sense of who was a rightist element, how that term was used, how its usage may have changed over time, and why. More extreme is Yang Jiaolong, who was one of the most accomplished jurists of his generation. Yang had the misfortune, because of his prestige and because of his acuity as a lawyer, to call out the CCP on its legal orthodoxy and to point out the flaws in the Yang PRC legal system. And for that, he was singled out as the top target in Shanghai's anti-rightist campaign in the legal community and declared a rightist and a counter-revolutionary and went to prison for over a dozen years. Now, the original paper issues of Law Science document the virulent backlash against Yang and his ideas, but the online editions, as you can see, omit the lion's share of this content. They've wiped the vast majority of it from the record as if it had never happened. Moreover, my analysis reveals that much the same can be said for others who, like Yang, promoted a raft of concepts connected to the rule of law or greater separation between party and state. He's just a more extreme example of a larger phenomenon. So why should we care? Why should censors and the government that presumably directs them bother to bury evidence of jurisprudential battles that were fought 60 years ago? Well, it can only be because those battles bear on issues of cardinal significance today. Since the late 1990s, the CCP has committed itself to constructing the rule of law in China. And under Article 5 of the state constitution, it specifically declares the PRC to be a rule of law state. But the CCP has a very idiosyncratic understanding of what this means. It has dissociated itself not only from foreign variants of the rule of law, like we would talk about Anglo-American rule of law, but also of Chinese ones that happen not to be socialist, like those endorsed by Republican governments before 1949 or on Taiwan today. And so that leaves it little choice but to look for legitimacy from